Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is writer and Guggenheim fellow Leela Philipp. She's also a contributing columnist at the Boston Globe and teaches in the Environmental Studies program at the College of the Holy Cross, where she is a professor in the English department. We're talking about her new book, Beaverland, How One Weird Rodent Made America. Leela, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you about this crazy book.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is a wonderful book, and it's fascinating, endlessly fascinating. But you really go down the rabbit hole, and that's sort of a mixed metaphor about beavers. Yeah, how long have you been enamored of beavers?
Well, thank you for that compliment. We'd have to say we go down to the beaver lodge, I think, right? Because you dive down to go into a beaver lodge,
you dive down
and come up. But first of all, I have to say I'm a writer, and I discovered beavers by accident. And before I answer your question, I should just say a little bit about myself and how I got started. So, I grew up on a farm in the Hudson Valley, and I think one of the great gifts of being on a farm as a kid was being bored and hot. remember those days when you had nothing to do and that actually meant you had everything to do? But anyway, there was a stinky pond on this farm and I loved it. And I spent a lot of time there swimming around with the frogs. And I was thinking about this. It occurs to me now that that frogs are sort of like beavers in a way, because beavers – come on land with us for a little while, but then they go into the water where we can't go. And so what happened for me was I was literally walking in the woods with my dog. It was my dog, Coda, who saw the beavers first. And, we saw this beaver. This beaver saw me. And then I saw what the beaver was doing, which was making this pond, cutting down these trees, making this woodland pond. It was one of the most startling, amazing things I had ever seen. I knew nothing about beavers before I began working on this book, but I really became obsessed with beavers and learning about them. And to answer your question, I would end up spending 6 years because just one question led to another. Yeah. I became more and more fascinating, not just with beavers, but what I learned is that they shaped this country. And I became fascinated with that and with how people have been fascinated by beavers since the time of Pliny the Elder. So it just became this kind of fever dream. The more I learned, the more fascinated I became until I was done. But if I may, when I say beavers made America, I'm not kidding.
No, you're not.
It's
in the book.
It's in the book. Read the book. So they jump-started transatlantic trade. It was really lust for this gorgeous, lustrous beaver fur that brought European explorers here. And then beavers would rev up the engines of capitalism in the 19th century. So, our first multimillionaire, John Jacob Astor, gets his start trading what? Beaver pelts. Right on the wharves of Manhattan. Just this incredible story. So, first of all, beavers, this weird, wonderful animal, amazed me. And then the story of beavers here in North America amazed me. And it's not just the economy. They shaped the land, literally.
Right.
And that really got me when I started to understand that they had shaped the rivers that shaped the land. And then we're living in the greatest crisis of our generation, and here we have this little 50-pound rodent who can help us with it. So I then really thought, wow, this is an amazing story for our time, because it's such a story of hope and resiliency for our moment, as well as just being an incredible, rollicking history of North America. So does that answer your question?
It does. And I want to mention that this is really more in the form of almost a journal. I mean, for people, this is not any dry, you're sort of looking at this in at a distance. This is a very personal story. And that's what makes it so sort of interesting, fascinating, and actually a lot of fun, too. I was driving out to birding the other day, and Sheila asked me, tell me five interesting things you learned from this book. And I went, I can't stop at five. So what I'm going to ask you are just some of the things that I found fascinating in this book, because this is a long story and you follow it in a lot of different ways. First of all, in the Pleistocene, there were giant beavers.
Yeah. I mean, I had so much fun with that. I mean, I had so much fun learning about beavers. And thank you for this opportunity, because really, when I finished the research on this book and then when I finished writing it, I thought, well, I'll be done with beavers. But apparently not, because every time I have the opportunity to talk about this book with people like you and share it with readers, I just get so excited about it.
You can tell. You can tell.
I mean, well, and there's so much more to learn, because what's interesting about this weird animal, and we really have to talk about the animal itself, is that we don't know that much about beavers, because they're not this charismatic mammal like a wolf or a lion or a bear that we've studied and admired. They're this rodent that, you know, we thought of them as pelts and made a lot of money off them and almost wiped them out. And then for far too long, we've thought of them as pests. So beavers need a rebrand fast, because they're incredibly valuable right now for our environmental future. And that's what science is showing us, and all these environmental restoration projects are, you know, that are harnessing beavers out west, here in the east. And I write about that in the book. And when I learned about that, I thought, wow, they're like a North American climate action resiliency plan right here, right now, in everyone's backyard. I mean, does it get any better than that?
Well, and not only that, I mean, a lot of aspects, and you bring this out many times in the book, by creating their beaver ponds, they actually create an increase in the amount of wildlife that's in that area.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much to unpack about what they do, and maybe we should talk about that a little bit.
Well, the great blue herons, for instance, love beaver ponds, and when the beaver ponds go away, so do the great blue herons.
Well, I'm watching beavers pond. It's called ponding when they go to a stream or a creek and build a dam and swell it out and make a pond. So what they'll do, and why they're so valuable, is they'll go to a stream or a creek and they'll make a dam and swell it out into a pond, and then they'll move downstream and they'll do it again, and then they'll do it again. So what you have is a beaver pond is never just a one-off. It's actually a succession of ponds. So pretty soon that stream or creek looks like a succession of like beads on a string if you looked from above. And these are called beaver damming complexes. So the rivers of North America before colonization, before like 1600 to 1900, that period that geologists now call the Great Drying, when we wiped out beavers and did a lot of timbering and drying out of the river system, was a completely different thing. You didn't have fast-running, straight streams and creeks that scoured the land and the water rushed through it the way it does in most places today. The water moved slowly, and it spread out. So what that meant was that the water was flowed down, cleansed, and it got down into the aquifer. So that's the value that beavers bring. And I should say, each of those ponds, and probably, you know, you've seen a beaver pond, and you see the average beaver pond here in the east is about a million gallons of water. Mm-hmm. But what I learned in researching the book that really just surprised me and just changed the way I looked at the river system is that each of those ponds has almost three times as much water underneath. So imagine three times as much water being held underneath in a great kind of sponge. So that water underneath is a reservoir of water that's there for drought. And it's also there, say we have these, you know, scalding rain events in the east, out west as well, by the way, with all these atmospheric rivers and this crazy weather that's happening with accelerated climate change. So those sponges, even a wet sponge, holds water. So each of those beaver ponds is both there for times of drought, and it's also flood retention pond, holding a lot of water and flowing it down. So it minimizes damage for floods. So beavers, it's kind of counterintuitive to think that beavers that bring water are actually going to help with flooding, but they help as much with flooding as they do with drought. So that's why people are so excited about the value beavers bring, because, you know, water is the story of our century, right? Too much water from extreme storms in one place is billions of dollars in damage from floods. Too little water in another place is drought, causing wildfire and loss of crops. So we've got a lot of problems with water, and beavers are all about managing water. That's just, that's what they do, and that's what they've done through the millennia, and that's why they shaped the continent. So when I realized that the rivers and the river system, you know, like most people, I thought of rivers as the mighty rivers, like the Hudson, the Mississippi, the Columbia. But a lot of our rivers are rivers we can't see. They're ghost rivers or hidden rivers, secret rivers, these kind of river system that's almost under the ground or under the ground. A lot of it managed historically by beavers. That just blew my mind, you know, to think that's why 400 million beavers, when this was Beaverland, was a completely different river system, and why the incredible wildlife abundance and you know, the incredible forests that explorers described when they came to this continent, it was incredible.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is writer, Guggenheim Fellow, Leela Philip. She is also a contributing columnist at the Boston Globe and teaches in the Environmental Studies program at the College of the Holy Cross, where she is a professor in the English department, and we're talking about her new book, Beaverland, How One Weird Rodent Made America. Leela, I want to talk about the constructive propensities of beavers. They create structures. They have their lodges that they live in. But they create these dams to manage the water that are amazing. And if anybody's ever sat there and watched beavers work on a dam, it is incredible. And there's, I think it's Lewis Henry Morgan in your book, talked about a beaver dam in the Upper Peninsula in 1868. It was this vast, long beaver dam that was amazingly structured. And you went and saw that same dam.
Yeah, thanks for mentioning that.
That's incredible.
Yeah, I found his map of these beaver dams in the Upper Peninsula, and I was really determined to see if any of them had prevailed. And in fact, you know, I write about this. I do find two of them, actually. And so the fact that they have prevailed for almost 200 years says a lot about the strength of these constructions and raises a lot of questions about beaver intelligence that are really unanswered. And this goes back to what we don't know about what beavers do is far greater than what we do know. We see their construction, and I think humans have marveled at them for a long, long time. And now I think scientists are studying them in a much more systemic way, in part for biomimicry. And I write about this really interesting researcher at Harvard, Dr. Kennedy, who's really done some interesting work.
She's talking about looking at beavers the way we look at bees, or ants, rather. And that we should be looking at the collective intelligence of beavers instead of just the individual.
Yeah, well, she did a lot of work on actually beaver damming complexes and has a lot to say as a trained engineer on those structures. And what by studying those beaver damming complexes, she not only pointed out that the dams are only part of the beaver damming complex, that actually one of the things that's managing water in a beaver damming complex are all the canals that beavers are creating. So they're basically creating a tremendous amount of connectivity between water and land. So imagine if a huge storm event comes through, the water is going to the right and the left instead of racing downstream through these canals. And it's diffusing a lot of force. And they also build dams in a succession, usually at least three. So if the top dam fails, the second catches it and the third. So there are a lot of interesting design questions that we could learn from in terms of beaver dam design. But the big thing that she identified is that beavers out there in Montana will build in response to what she believes is an environmental clue, which is or signal, which is that the flow rate, the current, is 250 liters per second. So when the water is at that rate exactly, they will start to build. And that was a significant finding because before that, people said, oh, beavers build to the sound of rushing water. But that doesn't really make sense because that might be one of the clues, but they never try to, you know, dam up Niagara Falls. If it were only the sound of rushing water, right, they would go to the biggest sound and start just building.
I think they would try to.
No, but they never do. And in fact, here I'm watching beavers, and they have built a dam, sure enough, at the perfect pinch point.
Yes.
Where it's just the most efficient place for them to build a dam. And how do they know how to do that? We don't fully know. They're only, 3 feet tall? They can't get up and look and survey the topography, but they seem to know. So some of it goes back to that weird paddle tail. So that crazy tail that looks like it's been run over by a tractor, you know, with these like indentations left, has to be the weirdest looking feature of this wonderful creature. Has all these blood vessels, and so it appears to be a sophisticated sensor for water pressure. So they don't need to, like, if someone breaks the dam and the water level goes down in a pond, they don't need to see that happening. They don't need to hear it. They can feel it from far away.
Wow.
And they'll swim over as soon as it's safe. And that tail also is their refrigerator during the winter. It gets filled with fat. They store fat in it, and they pretty much live off it.
That's why people, and you write about it in your book, that's why people loved eating beaver tail.
Yeah, it was really full, especially the early explorers and mountain men. They knew it was a really rich source of fat in a lean game diet. And it was I had fun writing about it in Europe too. It was very highly coveted because beaver could be eaten on Fridays in lieu of fish.
That's right. Yes, the Catholic Church did a great job there. The beavers were essentially fish.
Right. They were and they were considered a great delicacy because before beaver felt was discovered to be this incredible material for making of hats, beaver were valued for the castor, which is an internal gland, and it was valued for its medicinal purposes. So beaver castor was used for everything from headaches to insanity. I mean, it was really highly valued throughout the medieval world. And
we still use you said that we still use it today in like flavor.
Oh, everybody's eaten castor. You eat it in candy, ice cream.
Wow.
High-end colognes have castor in them, perfumes.
Because it's got, you mentioned, you wrote in the book, it's got notes of vanilla and something else.
Yeah, and very high-end men's cologne has a lot of beaver castor. High-end vodkas have beaver castor in them. You know, we've always utilized the beaver, but seriously, I think the beaver has a more useful and valuable role for us today if we can learn to harness and coexist alongside the beaver, because the role beavers can play now helping us with all of our challenges with water is phenomenal. And when I learned about this and started, you know, traipsing around the country writing about different projects, I was really, really surprised by the amounts of money people were saving. I mean, think about it. You've got millions of highly trained engineers willing to work for free. People who are harnessing that are very cleverly saving a lot of money, like Beaver Whisperer. His code name is Beaver Whisperer. But this, you know, environmental restoration manager who I write about down in the Chesapeake.
Oh, yeah.
He would stand in front of an 8-acre beaver pond and without blinking an eye, turn around and say, he's building constructions all throughout Maryland and the Chesapeake watershed. He could build it for $1 million or he could let beavers do it for free. Now, obviously, beavers can't do that everywhere, but there are many instances where beavers, if we let them, if we learn about how to work with them and what they're doing, they can actually do the work. And not only do we get the water, but to go back to your really important point about biodiversity, so these wetlands are really the coral reefs of North America.
Yeah. Yes.
So, I mean, I think that's a really important point you've raised. The biodiversity is incredible that they bring. And, you know, how do you put a dollar value on biodiversity, especially now?
You don't. Now, we're going to run out of time.
Uh-oh.
That's okay. but I have to ask you about Dorothy Richards.
Oh, yes.
I was telling people about this, and people were incredulous.
Yeah. Well, I met so many amazing people writing this book, you know. I
mean, well, she was dead, though. Dorothy was the one that...
Well, yeah. Well, I met her on the page. But I really had to research her and find out everything I could about her. Because here she is, this woman in the 30s, you know. she gets beavers. Soon enough, she's living in a tiny farmhouse in the southern Adirondacks with as many as, you know, she's got 14 beavers. She founds the first beaver sanctuary. And what's really interesting is, and I'm so glad you asked about her, is many of her observations about beavers, that beavers have a sense of humor, that they do not work purely on instinct, that they are making very reasoned choices, mm-hmm. and they have a kind of intelligence that is, now, we don't even have barometers for it yet.
Now, Leela, I'm going to stop you here because you glossed over an important point.
Yes.
The beavers were living in her house.
Yeah.
She wasn't just living next to a beaver pond. She had beavers living in her house.
Yeah, well, she got permission from the state to take two kits from her pond and bring them in and raise them. And then successive generations lived in her house so she could observe them, you know, on behalf of science. And she created a sort of education center. And now that the book has come out, I get letters and all kinds of correspondence from people who have met Dorothy Richards.
Oh, wow.
And who have been to Beaver Sprite. She had a big impact on people. And, you know, I really want to write more about her because I think she's an example of a woman who was, you know, okay, she was eccentric, but she was totally ahead of her time. She was a self-trained naturalist. And there are many self-trained naturalists who have made important contributions.
Mm-hmm.
And their contributions during their time have been ignored. And I think now that people are sending out robotic beavers and able to put cameras inside of beaver lodges, you know, in Norway they're doing that, and actually following beavers around with different technological instruments, we are actually recording things that she recorded. And at the time that she did it and she published a book about it, people discounted it and they said, nah, that can't be true. She's too emotionally attached to the beavers. This can't be right. But she was right. And I think that's also really interesting. She was observing things right up close to the beavers that were valuable and are now being supported by, you know, scientific studies.
There are some amazing photographs of her sitting at her table with the beaver.
Yeah, I mean,
now, the incredible thing is she was also married. And her husband wasn't that into beavers, but he was he was tolerant of the beavers.
Well, they had a deal. She wrote about this in the book. She would agree to play cards with him in town a couple nights a week, and he would agree to kind of help her with the beavers a certain, you know, nights of the week. And they didn't have any children, so they just, you know, they worked it out. But at a certain point, it was all out for the beavers. And then he died quite a number of years before she did, and then she was just completely all about the beavers. So, but her
what an amazing woman!
really amazing. And by the time she died, she put every penny she had into buying land to create this beaver sanctuary, and she donated, I think, almost 600 acres. And the sanctuary still exists. It's now run by the Utica Zoo. And two people, Sharon and Owen Brown, who I write about, have, you know, continued her work and founded a second sanctuary.
They're the ones that are feeding the beavers?
Yeah. Well,
corn. You went out and fed beavers corn, too.
Yes. It was an amazing experience because I had never been that close to beavers, and it was really magical. I'd seen them from a distance. I think often beavers, we see what they do, and we see them more by their kind of absence, or, you know, they're these creatures that can be with us and then they go under the water, and they're very mysterious because they have lives we can't really know. Although now with the internet, there are quite a few viral internet sensation beavers out there that are rescue beavers that are on Instagram.
I just love the way beavers, when you're standing there by the side of the water and they really don't want you there, they splash their tail like you would not believe. It's like somebody threw a boulder in the water.
Yeah, well, that's their signal. But, you know, they're very conflict averse. There have been a couple examples of beaver aggression, but I think they were probably had rabies or something, although they're not much of a vector for rabies.
Must be just an angry beaver.
Yeah. There was an example recently of a beaver where a muskrat moved in during the winter, and they don't really like muskrats, but what they did is they built a wall, which I think is really funny. And they were like, okay, you can be here just on your side.
Okay,
we're
completely out of time. And believe it or not, we have barely talked about this book. There's so much in this book, so much fascinating stuff. My guest tonight is writer and Guggenheim fellow Lila Philip. She's also a contributing columnist at the Boston Globe and teaches in the Environmental Studies program at the College of the Holy Cross, where she's a professor in the English department. And we've been talking about her book. It is really a great read. Beaverland, How One Weird Rodent Made America. Lila, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.